You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Religious liberty will be protected, and a law that requires free preventive care will not discriminate against women.
Today, the Ninth Circuit of Appeals said to our family and millions of Americans that we are equal under the law.
The dissenting opinion by Judge Smith said very clearly that there is a very rational and legitimate government reason for the protection of marriage between only a man and a woman.
For he took the uncleanness and captivity of all nations upon himself on the cross. He really and truly traded places with us all, that we be set free, the unclean made clean again.
Duluth, Minnesota letter carriers love Issues Etc.
One of the things that probably plagues the debate over homosexuality, in the U.S. at least, the most is junk science. We'll hear about research, we'll hear about researchers, we'll hear about scholarship on this issue and experiments on this issue, and often it's just that appeal to diffuse authority. What is the real social science here? What needs to be done? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Wednesday afternoon, February the 15th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking with Dr. Stanton Jones about the social sciences and homosexuality, not only what kind of science needs to be done, but what about the science that has been done, explaining questions like, is this biological in its root? Can sexual orientation change? Dr. Stanton Jones is provost and professor of psychology at Wheaton College. He's author of the book, Ex-Gays, A Longitudinal Study of Religiously Mediated Change in Sexual Orientation. And he's also written an article in the latest edition of First Things Journal titled Same-Sex Science. Dr. Jones, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, thank you for having me.
You say, and I think this is very revealing, that a lot of the science done on both sides of the debate of several questions regarding homosexuality suffers from a common problem, and that is the representativeness of the sample. What do you mean?
Yes, well, it's very important for people to understand that the science at its best is always limited, that there's always limitations to your methodology. And the big problem with the science about homosexuality is that the limitations of the studies are oftentimes brushed aside in a rush to push a certain agenda of interpretation. And so, as you say, the recurrent problem with the research on homosexuality is representativeness of the sample. And the best example I can give has to do with the genetic influence of the influence that genes have on the development of homosexual orientation. And so if in researching that subject, if you don't get a representative sample, a sample that truly has all the characteristics of all people that we know to be homosexual, then you could conceivably get a biased study. So the best example is a very influential study done in 1991 here in Chicago area, where a researcher, Michael Bailey, put out ads in the gay community announcing that he was doing a study on family influences in homosexuality. And so he came up with a genetic influence of what was called 52% concordance for homosexuality, which was widely interpreted that if one brother was gay, you had a 50% chance that the second brother was gay. But the problem was that because of the way he recruited his sample, the sample wasn't representative of homosexuality in general. And so better studies that have been done since and that have been largely ignored, they're larger, they're methodologically superior. But for instance, the latest study that was done on the twin registry of the nation of Sweden found that of 71 identical twin male pairs where one of the brothers was gay. Only in 7 of those instances was the second brother also gay. So this reduces our estimate. It doesn't mean that genetics is irrelevant, but it means that genetics does not have nearly as powerful of an influence, and that other factors have to be involved in the causation of sexual orientation. And so if you don't have those representative samples, you can get off on a track of misinterpreting and exaggerating your findings in any number of areas.
Is part of the problem that you're dealing with a relative to the population, a very small group?
That's exactly right. You know, the rumor that's out there is that we know that 10% or more of the population is homosexual. And in fact, we don't know anything of the sort. The best synthesis of latest findings is that perhaps 1.1% of the total population represents gay men, and an additional 0.8% of lesbian women. So perhaps 2% of the adult population is homosexually oriented, which is a small percentage. And then you add onto that the problem that in conducting your research, you have to find subjects. And so oftentimes the people who volunteer for research participation in research projects are people who are part of they are people who are proudly out, who are oftentimes connected to advocacy agencies, advocacy groups that have particular political inclinations, and there are certain types of research that fosters those advocacy directions, and other types of research that doesn't. And so, if people are differentially motivated to participate in studies, you again multiply the risk that your research is not going to be on a representative group. So, for instance, in studying the question, are homosexual relationships completely equivalent to heterosexual relationships? When Proposition 8 was rejected about a year ago by Judge Walker in the California's appeals court, he explicitly made the argument that research had shown that homosexual relationships are equivalent in quality and stability, was his term, to heterosexual relationships. Well, in fact, that's not the case. Research shows time and time again that the best research on more representative samples suggests that there are differentials in stability. So lesbian relationships and gay male relationships are less stable on average than heterosexual marriages. And there can be lots of reasons for that, but it's just simply not the case that they're absolutely equivalent.
To be fair, you also note that on the side that that is not simply the product of gay advocacy, don't seem to have an agenda, but on the side that would be concerned about homosexuality, would seeking reasons for it, there are also myths that abound. Give us an example of some of those.
Well, an example that would be relevant to my own research is that I've done research on the question whether persons of homosexual orientation can change. I think many conservatives like to believe that if somebody simply prayed the right way or were really motivated or really engaged the right technique, that anybody can change. And I think that that's unlikely to be true. It's actually that idea is one that you couldn't test empirically because of the ambiguity of what it means to change and so forth and so on. But we've done research. We want to reject the notion that's pushed in the gay advocacy area that nobody's sexual orientation can change, because there do appear to be individuals for whom change occurs. But that doesn't mean that everybody can change. And I know people of good faith, good motivation, of the deepest integrity, who have really devoted years of their life to trying to produce fundamental sexual orientation change, and they have not budged an inch in their experience. Some of those people I know go back into the gay community. Others of them commit themselves in the Christian church to the tradition of chastity. But these are people who have made good faith efforts to change. And I, you know, my personal belief, but one I don't think can be proven from science, is I do think that some people have the capacity to experience significant sexual orientation change. Other peoples do not, and frankly, some conservative evangelicals that I'm connected with are quite offended by that idea, because they really want to cling to the idea that anybody can change, anybody can experience profound sort of light switch change from gay to straight. And I just don't think that there's reason to believe that, either scientifically or theologically.
Let's talk about some of the social science with regard to some questions. With about a minute before our break, if you would, we are often told that homosexual persons are psychologically healthy as the average heterosexual. What does the social science tell us about this with about a minute before our break?
Yeah, in fact, every major study that's been done in this question on a representative sample has suggested higher instances of a variety of psychological distress variables, anxiety, depression, addictive behaviors, suicide attempts, are more common in the gay and lesbian community than in the straight community. Now, some of that is probably due to the kind of stress and negative reaction that individuals get, but it's not clear whether that accounts for all of the variables. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that homosexuality itself is a quote-unquote mental illness. Christians believe that, if you will, it's a moral disorder. That's the type of terminology that's used by the Catholic Church, and which many traditional Protestant groups have also adopted. So the fact that something is there are things that Christians object to morally that we think are wrong and are not conducive to flourishing of the human condition. So we regard them to be bad things. Sexual immorality, witchcraft, idolatry, pride, gossip, these are all things, but they're not necessarily mental illnesses per se.
So when the psychological community back in the 70s decided to reclassify homosexuality from a mental illness to something else, that was actually an accurate move on their part. About a minute here.
You know, it was a move that was driven in part by legitimate findings from science. It was also driven in part by a political response to the gay advocacy movement that was really gaining steam at that time. To be honest, I'm somewhat agnostic as to whether it was a good move or a bad move. I, as a Christian, I have to believe that homosexual orientation is not the intended outcome of the best trajectory of human development. And so, if pushed, you know, to ask, is there something wrong, I have to say, well, because of my moral convictions, I have to believe that this is not the intended outcome for human flourishing. But then I don't experience the intended outcome of human flourishing. I'm broken and twisted in many ways, and it is part of my overall trajectory of God's work in my life to bring good out of that brokenness. And I think we all share that same human condition.
Dr. Stanton Jones is our guest. We're talking about the social sciences and homosexuality on this Wednesday afternoon, February the 15th. I'm Todd Wilkins. Stay tuned. How does Jesus' incarnation provide us with a response to religious relativism? Find out in an article that I've written for the latest issues, etc. journal. It's titled God in a Box, and we'll send it to you for free. Just send an email to journal@issuesetc.org. You can also read about Pastor Michael Schuerman's journey from moralistic therapeutic deism to the rock-solid theology of the Reformation. The online Issues, etc. journal, journal@issuesetc.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start. The foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House. cph.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues, Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues, Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology, and we'd like to send you an Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the social sciences and homosexuality with Dr. Stanton Jones. Dr. Jones, one of the bedrocks of the debate on both sides is whether or not sexual orientation is biologically determined. From the side of the pro-gay advocates, they say it is. Does the science support that?
You know, this is an area, again, where a lot of conservatives are prone to believe that biology plays no part, and they're, in fact, very, very wired to reject that notion. And I think that's a mistake on conservatives' part. I think there is evidence that genetics contributes something. There may be other biological factors that we can't yet put our fingers on. So the science is very undetermined at this point in time, but it points to some contribution of biology. But people have to remember that the fact that biology contributes something doesn't mean that it contributes everything. And so I can have a biological predisposition in a certain area, but there are many kinds of biological predispositions that only get enacted when they interact with certain kind of family experiences or experiences in the environment. In fact, there's a whole new field that's developing in academia around just this idea. It's the field of epigenetics, which is the idea that genes, if you will, click on and click off in response to environment. So there may be genes that sit dormant until a certain kind of stress hits that person. And then the stress triggers a genetic reaction that, if you will, is an interaction of the person's biology and the person's psychological and real-life experience. And so there are probably all kinds of variables, like the condition of the family, the type of parenting the person experiences, experiences in friendship. Is the person exposed to certain kinds of sexual stimuli as a child? I mean, there are any number of a cascade of experiences that likely interact with the biology. And so there's no one, you know, we oftentimes want to stretch for simplistic explanatory metaphors. We want to know, if I drop my baby on its head, the following thing will happen. Well, there isn't that one causal variable. There's likely, just like with many other physical conditions we're struggling, many kinds of physical diseases and so forth, well, this contributes 10%, and this contributes 15%, and this contributes 8%, and so forth and so on. The human condition is extraordinarily complex. Christians believe we are physical beings, and so our biology matters. And yet our biology is not everything about us. We are bodies, but we are more than our bodies. And so when we talk about causation, Christians should not have a knee-jerk reaction against the idea that biology contributes something, but neither should they buy the argument that biology is everything.
So in other words, biological contributors cannot be ruled out at this time.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely right.
Let's talk about something that you mentioned before. Go into more detail, if you would, about the changeability of sexual orientation.
Yes. Well, I can best cite that by my own study. Let me back up. There were a spate of dozens and dozens of studies in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s suggesting that some homosexuals could respond well to therapy and change. So these studies were never overly optimistic. Maybe a fourth of the people, maybe a third of the people changed as a result, experienced more profound change. Others were helped somewhat, but they didn't have that kind of experience of profound change. So those studies were out there, but beginning in the 1980s, after the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality as a diagnostic category, there was sort of a retreat from this idea. And slowly those studies began to be viewed in disfavor. I think the major thing that happened was anecdotes began to emerge of people saying, well, I was in that study and I didn't change, or I heard this horror story about that treatment intervention and so forth. And so there was just a distancing from these studies, and in the interim, very little research has been done on this. And that vacuum of research has created an environment that says, well, we don't have clear evidence that change is possible. We don't know what to make of those old studies, and therefore we can draw the conclusion that change is impossible for everyone. But in the interim, there's all kind of anecdotes that at least some people do experience profound change. Granted, some people, there are plenty of anecdotes of people who tried really hard and they didn't, but there are these other anecdotes of the possibility of change. The study that my colleague Mark Yarhouse and I published recently in the Journal of Sex and Marital Therapy was really the first longitudinal study that followed the people over multiple years as they attempted to change their sexual orientation. We did not study a group of people that were going through therapy. We studied a group of people who were going through ministries related to Exodus International, which is a Protestant evangelical umbrella group that has a lot of diverse ministries that try to heal. The terminology they use is, we try to heal sexual brokenness. And the short story is that we followed this group of 98 people over 7 years, sampling them multiple times on understanding their sexual orientation, on their psychological distress status, and so forth and so on. And what we found is that there seemed to be no intrinsic harm to trying to change sexual orientation. And while we found some people who tried and failed to change, we did find some people reporting profound change. And I would say the rough summary would be that of the people that were left in our study at the end of the 7 years, which was 61 out of this original 98, roughly a fourth had experienced what they reported as profound sexual orientation change, from homosexual to heterosexual. Another fourth had embraced chastity, and so they were still homosexually oriented, but they had found satisfaction and a healthy, what they regarded as a healthy way to live as a celibate single person within the Christian church. And then about a fourth of the people were still pursuing change but not getting much merit from it, and about a fourth of the people had gone back to gay lifestyle and gay identity in some form and had given up on the change process. Now, I don't think those statistics are reliable, because I don't want to be guilty of the very thing I was criticizing other scientists about. We did not have a representative study of all people who want to change. But that wasn't our question. Our question wasn't what percentage can change. Our question was simply, is it possible for anybody to change? And we feel like our evidence stands as an example of the fact that it appears that some people have some capacity to change.
So, again, it is simply not true that it cannot be changed, and it's simply not true that it can in every case be changed.
That's exactly right. The truth winds up being more complex than what we thought. People on the quote-unquote progressive side want to say, science has proven that no one can change. I would argue that that is empirically false. Many conservatives, in knee-jerk reaction, want to say, anybody and everybody can change, and I think we've got no good reason to believe that. The reality is, some people appear to be able to change. Sexual orientation is very mysterious and complex phenomenon, and I think we're just beginning to expand our understanding of this dimension of human experience.
What about the assertion that heterosexual and homosexual relationships are equivalent in virtually every way?
You know, I think that the best evidence is yet to be obtained. This is one area where we have fewer really good representative studies. One key dimension that is relevant to a lot of questions has to do with relational stability. And the best study out there is a study of the national data banks for the nations of the Netherlands and Denmark. And this demographic study of well over 2 million people examined these relationship stabilities, and two things really stood out. One is that gay men established legal civil unions in these countries over about a decade at about half the rate. They established these relationships at about the same rate at which lesbian women did, which is very significant because the statistics show over and over and over again that there are about twice as many gay men as there are lesbian women. And remember that I said that about 1.1% of the population is gay men, and the percentage of lesbian women is, let me make sure I get this straight, is 0.6%. So it's roughly twice as many gay men as lesbian women. But if lesbian women are then applying for civil unions at about the same rate as gay men, it means that gay men are only about half as likely to try to enter into these stable civil unions as are gay homosexual women. And then the second finding from this study was that there was more instability of these relationships of homosexuals in individuals over a long period of time, so that gay men were about 50% as compared to heterosexuals, 50% more likely for those relationships to break up within that time period. And lesbian women were actually 167%, more than three times as likely as the heterosexual marriages to break up. And that goes together with a lot of other evidence indicating that stability is a challenge and an issue. Another thing that has emerged pretty consistently from the finding is around the issue of monogamy. A very high percentage of gay men who are in stable relationships, monogamous relationships, are not, in fact, sexually monogamous. There is a very high incidence of sexual experimentation, if you will, outside of the relationship, and oftentimes this is consensual for the individuals. So there are some of these significant variables on which it appears that homosexual and heterosexual relationships, on average, are different, and these are you know, just troubling dimensions on which to make decisions about social policy, such difficult social policy as, do we grant marriages? What about adoption? Exactly how should homosexual couples be treated in relationship to heterosexual couples?
So again, what we have there is a situation where the assertion that they are equivalent, heterosexual and homosexual relationships in all important characteristics, is not true. But it cannot be said that, for instance, as it is asserted often, that gay men are incapable of forming monogamous relationships, and they generally live kind of serial monogamy, or rather promiscuous multiple partner relationships, and that's characteristic of their
situation. That's exactly right. People need to be very cautious about any generalizations. To say that homosexual individuals cannot have a relationship characterized by stability, love, monogamy, and so forth and so on is simply not true. It is certainly the case that examples can be put forward. When we deal with these kind of normative questions in science, we're talking about what the averages show for representative samples. And so there are tendencies there that suggest they are not equivalent, but to say that no relationship could be equivalent, it would be a mistake. You're absolutely right.
Let's take another break. When we come back, we'll conclude our conversation on the social sciences and homosexuality on this Wednesday afternoon, February the 15th, with Dr. Stanton Jones. He's provost and professor of psychology at Wheaton College. He's author of the book, Ex Gays, A Longitudinal Study on Religiously Mediated Change in Sexual Orientation. And he's also written an article in the latest edition of First Things titled Same-Sex Science.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Dr. Stanton Jones is our guest. 10 more minutes with him talking about the social sciences and homosexuality. Dr. Jones, the last thing I wanted to talk to you about before some general questions is the often unstated assumption that sexual orientation is, to put it in layman's terms, the be-all and end-all of one's personal identity.
Yes. And this is an area where it seems to me that it's very clear that claims are being made from science where science is being pushed way, way beyond its legitimate boundaries. It's one thing for science to say this variable, sexual orientation, is correlated with this variable, whether it's psychological well-being or self-esteem or something like that. But science by itself cannot say this is a, in the words of my American Psychological Association, is a positive and normal variant of human sexuality. You cannot simply take everything that is and say the fact that it exists makes it normal, because there are any number of things that exist. It's really a theological and philosophical and ethical judgment as to what is normal, what is good. And so, you know, take the issue of polygamy. It's a reality that polygamy exists in the world. Does that make it a good thing or a bad thing? Well, that's really a philosophical question, an ethical question, a theological question, not a scientific question. Science can document, in a sense, what is. It can document what seems to be correlated with this. We can ask really important questions about, is polygamy and or monogamy associated with human flourishing as defined in the following ways? But science doesn't answer these questions for us, and it's particularly frustrating for me that that my professional organization, the American Psychological Association, is pushing very hard on these issues, and I think are stepping beyond the bounds of science in making such claims.
So, how would you summarize all of this? Whether it be the question of equivalency of relationships, psychological makeup of someone who is homosexual, or the issue of sexual orientation's changeability, how would you summarize it?
Well, boy, that's a tall order. I guess my most important summary would be that in the debates that we have in our culture about really crucial things, how are we going to understand intimate relationships? How are we going to understand marriage? How are we going to understand families? There's a desire, if you will, because we can't agree on the moral arguments, to punt to science and let science satisfy our, give us our answer to solve the issue for us. And I would say fundamentally science can't do that. Science points in directions that suggest that homosexual persons are different on average on quite an array of significant variables. And how we value those differences is a matter that we have to go back to fundamental questions of religion, fundamental questions of ethics, fundamental questions of philosophy and theology to solve those issues. I would argue that, in quick summary, that that there's evidence that biology contributes something to the development of sexual orientation, but it's not all inclusive. There's evidence that some individuals can change sexual orientation, but there's no evidence that everybody can. There's evidence that there's more psychological distress among persons of same-sex orientation, but it's not clear what causes that, and it's not clear that some of that distress may be endemic to being attracted to a person of the same sex. And I think the best science suggests that homosexual relationships are not equivalent to heterosexual relationships. It's up to us, as we grapple with ethics and so forth, to ask, do the differences matter?
What about the general question of normalcy? And that is, and I think what's behind a lot of the debate is, between, is homosexuality normal human behavior? I mean, looking at the kind of incredibly small minority that it is in the population, one might be, you know, thereby tempted to conclude, well, no, it can't be if it's that small in the population. Has the science been done? Can science answer that question?
I believe very strongly that science cannot answer that question. I think science can contribute to the knowledge we bring to answering that question, but science is not going to answer that question. And I think that the Christian community, one of the things that we really need to grapple with as we think this through is the importance and the nature of religious liberty. And I've come increasingly under the conviction that religious liberty is in jeopardy in our culture. The Christian community needs to grapple with the nature of religious community. Religious liberty, and we need to think these issues through in terms of how religious liberty applies to us, and also how it applies to people who want to disagree about fundamental moral questions. And so we need to think through issues of, I think there have been a history of being overly repressive towards people who choose to live in accord with their same-sex desires, and we need to not fall back into a pattern that that is unnecessarily repressive. If Christians want to be respected for their religious liberty, including liberty lived out in the public sphere, then we need to also respect the rights of others to say, I understand your position, but I disagree with your moral conclusions, and therefore I choose to live my life differently. Now, that has implications for how we do public school sex education. It has implications for how we do, you know, family policy and so forth and so on. But and I'm not expert on all those areas. Science can contribute something, but we need to continue a reasoned and civil public debate, but one that is grounded on a respect of religious liberty.
What kind of science does need to be done? Where do you see a blind spot in research on the issue of homosexuality?
I think there's a very good trajectory of ever better science being done in this area. So I'm not sure that there is a crucial area that hasn't been touched, but I think some of the evidence about what is it that causes same-sex orientation, I think that's a legitimate area to continue to press on. There's probably a need for more research about psychological and experiential factors, since those tend to be disfavored in today's political environment. It needs to be okay to talk about psychological and environmental contributors. And probably there's a great need for research also on parameters of change. Right now, people who desire to change are really demonized, and they are quite hesitant to be examined in psychological studies. We even with our relatively sympathetic ear to that community, we experienced real difficulties in getting people to sign up for our study, because there's a sense in which science is always used against us, and so how do we think that through? So more informed and balanced study on questions like who can change, what is it that helps them to change, what's important in terms of maintaining change, and so forth, are all legitimate questions for further study.
At the end of your article, you write this, and I'm curious what you mean. You say, as religious believers, we must confess our own culpability in creating the mess we're in, and you're talking about the polarization in society over here. You say, we were complicit, even if ignorantly and passively so, in the cultural embrace of the disease conceptualization of homosexuality. We offloaded responsibility for the articulation of a thoughtful, caring, theologically rich, and pastorally sensitive understanding of sexual brokenness. What do you mean by that, with about a minute and a half?
Okay. Well, I can perhaps best flesh it out by using an example that I see over and over and over again in churches. And I teach in a religious educational institution, and I see this in institutions like my own and in other contexts as well. So often, the conservative religious believers think of this issue of same-sex orientation only in terms of, if you will, the quote-unquote culture wars. So very quickly, gay and lesbian individuals become the enemy. And in that context, we create a self-fulfilling spiral where, because of concern about the direction that the cultural forces are going, gay and lesbians become the enemy, and we don't want to talk with compassion. We don't want to have relationships with those individuals. It's very important. I look at the model of Christ as one who engaged with love those that he most wanted to reach out to. He engaged in dialogue. He never bent his standards. He never demonstrated a lack of integrity, but he showed a passionate commitment to engagement with a community that was of people that he wanted to reach out to. And I think the church sometimes talks to itself, because it talks about these culture wars. And in that context, you have people sitting in the pew right next to you, sitting in the desk right next to you in the classroom, who experience same-sex attraction. And if all they hear is that the gays and lesbians are the enemy, that they are the bad guys, they are the morally inferior persons, then those people feel, in a sense, pushed out of the church. We need to change to be more thoughtful. We need to recognize the pastoral dimension of our relationship as well as the policy issues. We don't kiss the policy issues goodbye. These are important questions. Is it a good thing or a bad thing if gay marriage is widely embraced in America? These are important questions. I personally think it's not a good thing. I would vote against it if I had a chance to do so at a poll. But that should not also interfere with my capacity to reach out to my homosexual neighbor, whether individual or as a couple, and to establish a relationship of care, of respect, one where I can be transparent and say, here's where I disagree with you. Let's talk. Let's have a relationship. I want to protect your basic civil rights. I want to respect you as a human being. I want to see you as a person made in the image of God, and I want to be for your long-term good.
Dr. Stanton Jones is provost and professor of psychology at Wheaton College, author of the book Ex-Gays, a Longitudinal Study of Religiously Mediated Change in Sexual Orientation. He's also written an article in the latest edition of First Things Journal titled Same-Sex Science. You can find out more about Dr. Jones' book Ex-Gays under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, here's an email. It's from Seth, and it's about our new Issues Etc. iPhone app. He says, good app, no nonsense. It takes you where you want to go, whether to listen live or download podcasts. Thanks. That's what we were aiming for. You can get the Issues Etc. iPhone app or Android app at our website, issuesetc.org. They're both free, and they're both for you to take Issues Etc. wherever you go, in the palm of your hand, the Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app.
Hi, this is Jonathan calling from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. It very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Greetings from your friends at Zion Lutheran Church, Muscoda, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Zion Lutheran is a welcoming, family-friendly church that's firmly grounded on the unchanging truth of God's Word. We receive God's gifts of grace in a timeless, reverent way each Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Zion Lutheran is located at 101 South Railway in Muscoda, Illinois. Zion Lutheran is a church home that's both faithful and friendly, and you'll be warmly welcomed. For more information, call 618-566-7345.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Steadfast Lutherans. People who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The Gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the Gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.